From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As communities across the U.S. celebrated the holiday for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, at the UN, a briefing by Farhan Haq, a deputy spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, discussed a number of hotspots where war still prevails across the world.
Good afternoon and happy Martin Luther King Day to one and all. In a joint statement issued today, the heads of the UN's main humanitarian bodies appealed once more for immediate, unconditional, and safe access to reach the children and families who are still cut off from humanitarian aid across the country. In Syria today, they said, there are 15 besieged areas where up to 700,000 people, including an estimated 300,000 children, still remain trapped. Nearly 5 million people, including more than 2 million children, live in areas that are extremely difficult to reach with humanitarian assistance due to fighting, insecurity, and restricted access. In particular, children are at heightened risk of malnutrition, dehydration, diarrhea, infectious diseases, and injury. Many need support after being exposed to traumatic events, violence, and other violations. The humanitarian agency heads argued that we must not let 2017 repeat the tragedies of 2016 for Syria. And that statement was put out by Emergency Relief Coordinator Stephen O'Brien, UNICEF Executive Director Anthony Lake, WFP Executive Director Erthrin Cousin, WHO Director General Margaret Chan, and UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi. Still on Syria, the UN is alarmed by the reports of an attack on the technical team that went to Wadi Barada to assess damages to water infrastructure at the Al-Fiji spring site. On the 14th of January, a member of the Reconciliation Committee was reportedly killed at the assessment site. Consequently, the assessment mission was suspended. The technical team, comprising Syrian, Arab, Red Crescent, and water authorities, remains on standby to enter the area again to complete their mission as soon as security conditions allow. The UN team is in contact with the water authority and the Syrian, Arab, Red Crescent, and also stands ready to enter the area and provide additional support to ensure the swift repair of the water infrastructure. Meanwhile, the fighting in the Wadi Barada area has displaced an estimated 17,500 people since the 22nd of December. For over 3 weeks, 5.5 million people in Damascus and surrounding areas have been cut off from their main water source due to the fighting in Wadi Barada. The UN continues to support the water authorities with the water quality testing equipment, consumables, and chemicals needed to undertake necessary water quality tests. The UN calls on all parties to the conflict to ensure unrestricted and safe access for technical teams in order to restore the provision of water, which is essential to the well-being of the civilian population. The United Nations welcomes the first anniversary of the achievement of Implementation Day under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, which marked a significant milestone in the historic agreement reached by the E3 plus 3, and Iran on the 14th of July 2015 and endorsed by the Security Council in its Resolution 2231 of 2015. The agreement underscores the importance of diplomacy in ensuring that Iran's nuclear program remains exclusively peaceful while also promoting peace and security in the region. The United Nations welcomes the reaffirmation by all sides of their strong commitment to the continued full and effective implementation of the JCPOA, including in the meeting of the Joint Commission held in Vienna on the 10th of January 2017, and encourages all member states to support its implementation in its entirety. It is of the utmost importance that the JCPOA works in the interests of all its participants, including by delivering tangible benefits to the Iranian people. The United Nations shall continue to support the implementation of the JCPOA in accordance with Resolution 2231 and other relevant decisions of the Security Council. Nikolai Mladenov, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, today welcomed the signature of an agreement to renew the activity of the Israeli-Palestinian Joint Water Committee to improve the water infrastructure and supply in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. This, along with previous joint agreements on electricity, water, mail, and 3G cellular coverage, is in line with the Middle East Quartet's recommendations. If fully implemented, Mr. Mladenov said, this agreement would be an important step towards preserving the two-state solution. He encouraged further cooperation between the two sides, which is critical to the viability of a future Palestinian state. And you'd asked earlier who would represent the United Nations at yesterday's Paris conference on the Middle East. Mr. Mladenov attended on the Secretary General's behalf. Also, I was asked about an article that appeared in Al Monitor that purported to express the Secretary General's views on the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I can say that the views contained in the article are pure speculation. The Secretary General's approach to the Israeli-Palestinian question will become more clear in the weeks and months ahead. The Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Syed Jinnit, and the Special Representative of the Secretary General for the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Maman Sidiku, kick-started a series of joint consultations to address the presence of elements of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, army, and opposition in eastern DRC. They met last week with the governor of North Kivu, Julien Paluku, and with ex-combatants accommodated in Munigi camp. And following meetings with national authorities in Kinshasa, they agreed with the DRC government to establish a joint technical committee tasked to develop some options for the relocation of the ex-combatants. This committee is scheduled to have its first meeting on the 18th of January, 2017. A new report published today by the UN mission in South Sudan and the UN Human Rights Office details the grave human rights violations and abuses, as well as serious violations of international humanitarian law committed in Juba during and after the fighting that occurred between the 8th and 12th of July, 2016. 6 months after the violence, there remains widespread impunity as violations continue unabated. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein stressed that in the absence of any semblance of justice and accountability for the violations perpetrated, including possible war crimes, such unbridled outbursts of violence could quickly escalate. The report urges the South Sudanese government to take action to break the cycle of violence and impunity and take steps to fully support the prompt establishment and operationalization of the hybrid court for South Sudan by the African Union. On Sudan, the resident and humanitarian coordinator in the country, Marta Ruedas, as well as the UN African Union mission in Darfur, UNAMID, have both welcomed the easing of sanctions imposed by the United States against the Republic of Sudan. Ms. Ruedas noted that this decision is recognition of steps taken by the government of Sudan during recent months in a number of important areas. She congratulated the government and the people of Sudan on the implementation of these steps, which include key decisions that will facilitate humanitarian actors' efforts to deliver aid to those in need. And the acting joint special representative and joint chief mediator, Jeremiah Nmamabolo, called on all Sudanese stakeholders to take advantage of this window of opportunity to reflect on peace and reconciliation. The Assistant Secretary General for Political Affairs, Miroslav Yencha, delivered a message from the Secretary General for the 25th anniversary of the Salvadoran Peace Accords today. That message stressed that the Salvadoran peacemaking and peace-building experience left a lasting impression on the United Nations, with the UN Observer mission in El Salvador teaching us that peace-building must place human rights at the center of all our work. In May of last year, the government of El Salvador sought the Secretary General's good offices to facilitate dialogue among Salvadorans and reach agreements on key challenges facing the country. Today, the Secretary General is announcing the appointment of Benito Andion of Mexico as a special envoy to facilitate dialogue in El Salvador. We have a full bio available in our office. The first UN World Data Forum officially opened today in Cape Town, South Africa. The forum has drawn more than 1,200 participants from governments, national statistics offices, the private sector, civil society, and the scientific and academic communities. The Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, Wu Hongbo, said that he expects the forum to serve as a launching pad where diverse data producers and users can get behind the Cape Town Global Action Plan for Sustainable Development Data. He also expects partnerships to be created or strengthened, as well as a growing consensus on issues such as data privacy. And for Press Encounters, at 11 a.m. tomorrow, there will be a press briefing on the launch of the World Economic Situation and Prospects 2017 report. Speakers will include Lenny Montiel, the UN Assistant Secretary General for Economic Development. And that is it for me. Do we have any questions? Yes, Edie.
Thank you, Farhan. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said today that the EU is hoping to hold a conference on the rebuilding of Syria in April in tandem with the United Nations. Can you confirm that this is in the works and that the UN will be a co-sponsor?
Not at this stage. There is some planning going on, but we don't have a formal announcement to make on this. Once we have something, I'll let you know. Yes. Let me.
Sure. Some other stuff. But just on the announcement by the Sudan resident coordinator, you may have seen that on Saturday, the Sudanese Congress Party and other opposition figures were banned from traveling out of the country to Paris. And I just wonder, how does this relate to this announcement of welcoming? Is the UN concerned that Sudan continues to block opposition figures from traveling out of the country? How does it relate also to freedom of the press, where there have been a number of newspapers with their full circulation seized?
Well, those are distinct issues. Obviously, the fact that we've seen some improvements on the humanitarian side doesn't preclude the fact that we still have concerns about human rights in Sudan, and those concerns continue, including involving the treatment of political parties and of the press. And we do continue to call on the Sudanese government and the authorities to respect freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and other basic rights.
I guess I'm just saying, because I've seen Ms. Rueda's full statement, and none of those issues were mentioned in it. And it just sort of seems like, isn't it like the UN looking at all of these issues?
Yes, it is. She's giving credit on one aspect, and so that statement is directed to one particular aspect of the issue. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other aspects that we continue to be concerned about, and our human rights concerns remain and are on the record. Yes.
Farhan, two questions. First of all, sources say today's your 50th birthday. True. Can you confirm?
Yes, I can. I'm 50.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
And secondly, on the Secretary General's meeting with the Chinese president this week, can you give us a little more detail on this and what the reasoning is behind him doing it in Geneva, and, you know, just a little more detail?
Well, as you know, Xi Jinping will be in Geneva. This is a fairly important trip by the Chinese president. As far as I'm aware, this is the first time in quite some time that you've had a so senior Chinese official visit our Geneva offices. And so we're very encouraged by that. The Secretary General will want to see him to talk about a range of issues of mutual concern. As you know, China is a very important part of the UN system. And among other things, as you know, it's one of the five permanent members of the United Nations, and so this is a good opportunity for the Secretary General to talk to the leaders of one of those key states. We'll also try to provide a readout of that meeting once it has taken place, but as we pointed out, the Secretary General will see him, and then from there we'll go on to Davos for the World Economic Forum.
But is there any particular item on their agenda? And is also in the week ahead, there was some mention of some event that they were going to be doing together?
I believe we had mentioned some of this on Friday. We have some of the details in our Friday briefing. But beyond that, any further details we'll have as the meeting transpires. Yeah.
Farhan, on these talks on the South Sudanese rebels in the DRC, how many are there now, and has any country stepped up and agreed to take some in?
I don't have the numbers with me, but I believe that we can get those for you from the officials we have in the DRC. At this stage, what we're trying to do is just have a dialogue going on between, as we just pointed out, the officials in North Kivu and also with the SPLA in opposition forces. So we're trying to maintain the sort of peace that we have in that area and see whether that continues. But I don't have any confirmation of anyone else, of any other country stepping in to take these particular individuals. Yes.
Sure. I wanted to ask you, these Burundian talks facilitated by Mr. Mkapa, So, Merge, I'd asked this in December, I guess, in writing to you, but one of his team members that's being supported by the UN is a person that's listed in the November 2009 DRC sanctions report as being a supporter of CNDD-FDD, and there's actually some allegations that he was involved in helping to arm them. So I'm just wondering, what is the relationship between the UN's support of these talks and what many are calling a lack of inclusiveness and the inclusion of people that are listed in UN sanctions reports?
Well, obviously the sanctions remain in place, and it's a matter for the Security Council and its relevant sanctions committees to make sure that those sanctions are implemented. We at the UN, of course, respect those sanctions. That's a separate issue from the need for mediation. Of course, we need to make sure that all mediation efforts, including those under former President Mkapa, are supported, and we're continuing to do so with our officials in the region.
But have you seen the response by large parts of the Burundian opposition that the most recent round is the most one-sided yet, and that it's virtually, I mean, they're not really included. So what's the UN's role in these talks?
We're certainly aware of the objections by the various sides. We're trying to make sure that as the process continues, it can be as inclusive as possible. And we'll continue, including through Jamal Ben Umar's office, to try to reach out to all the various parties. Yes, please.
Thanks, Farhan. Again, happy birthday.
Thanks.
After last week's arrest and release of former Prime Minister of Kosovo, Ramush Haradinaj, in France on Serbian arrest warrants through Interpol, then blackmailing of France to extradite him to Serbia, we witnessed this last 2 days another nationalist incident from Serbia. They sent that so-called Russian train to Kosovo, and then Kosovo sent the police to the border to stop the train. Thanks God, everything ended peacefully, though President of Serbia threatened to send the army there. What Secretary General stand on this? Can he do something? Because actions like this do undermine the reconciliation and, the dialogue in Brussels that is being facilitated from EU and supported and backed from UN.
Mm-hmm. Well, the UN, of course, supports the EU-backed dialogue and efforts of dialogue between Pristina and Belgrade, and will continue to do so. And we stand against any kind of actions, including rhetoric, that would undermine that dialogue. We want to make sure that the parties continue to be in touch with each other and avoid such steps. Yes.
Thank you, Farhan, and happy birthday also.
Thank you.
On Yemen, Jamie McGoldrick, the OCHA coordinator, announced today that the conflict has reached 10,000 deaths and 40,000 others wounded. Does the Secretary General have any comment on this number, which is significantly higher than previous estimates? And secondly, on Yemen, the UN envoy, Sheikh Hamad, is in Aden today, and according to Yemeni officials, he's presenting a new peace plan to President Hadi. Is this something that you can confirm? Are there any details?
On your second point, yes, I can confirm that the special envoy, Ismail Ul Sheikh Ahmed, is in Aden today. He is scheduled to meet with President Hadi, and he will try to present him with the latest peace proposals. Obviously, it's nothing that I can give details of. This is something that he's been developing in dialogue with the various parties, and that dialogue will continue. And we'll continue to try to provide periodic details of his travels as they proceed. But right now, I don't have any particular press release or information about the Aden visit. Although, yes, I can confirm it has begun and he is there. Regarding the figures by Mr. McGoldrick, of course, we stand by what our humanitarian coordinator is saying, and this once more underscores the need to resolve the situation in Yemen without any further delay. There's been a huge humanitarian cost, which we have been mentioning periodically. Yes.
Thank you, Farhan. Happy birthday. And a quick clarification. Did the UN receive a formal invitation to attend the Astana talks supposed to be held on the 23rd of January?
Not so far. We do expect at some point that we may have a role, but we're awaiting to see what that will be. Yes.
Sure. I wanted to ask you about in Bahrain, there was these execution of three people. Some people, human rights activists, have said they were probably tortured. Anyway, their execution has set off unrest, including the setting ablaze of City Hall. And I'm just wondering, what is the UN? Does the UN, is there any response from the UN, both either to the executions or to the unrest that's followed?
As you're aware, we have our long-stated concerns about capital punishment, and we would restate them here. You're well aware that we do oppose the continued institution of capital punishment, and those concerns apply in this case as well. Regarding demonstrations, of course, we hope that any demonstrations against this would be peaceful, but certainly we hope that the authorities will allow for freedom of expression and freedom of assembly. Yes, Sherwin.
Happy birthday, and yes to the next five decades. On what's going on in Gambia and this notion of a standby force in Senegal that is on standby to oust the president by force if required, does the UN have a position on such action, which would, without Security Council approval, appear quite unprecedented in many aspects?
I don't have any comment about any such force, which the implementation of which is at this stage hypothetical. Right now, what we're still hoping for is that that the process in Gambia will continue to allow for the inauguration, as detailed in the constitution, on the 19th of January of the president-elect Adama Barrow. We have been working with the various parties, including the Economic Community of West African States, to push for that resolution, and we hope that that is what will happen next. Yes.
Sure. I'm going to ask about, I guess, Cyprus and then also UN reform. I'm sure you've seen the coverage of the Cyprus talks. A large number of the stories said that the Greek foreign minister and the secretary general didn't get along, and with that quote, here's a quote from one of the stories: Guterres was so irritated that he has refused to sit in the same room as the Greek foreign minister in the foreseeable future. There are at least three different articles and three separate media saying this. So I'm just wondering, how would you characterize the participation of the Greek foreign minister and the secretary general's view going forward on his participation?
No, I mean that's not. That's not accurate. What I would say is that the Secretary General has been dealing and will continue to deal with all the various sides regarding this. You'll have seen what the Secretary General said last week, and I would just refer you back to the text of what he said. We continue to hope that there will be an agreement. Obviously, we want to make sure that this is a lasting and sustainable agreement, and we will work in good faith with all the various sides.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you about this memo, the terms of reference for new/revised Office of Executive Secretary General posts and units that talks about, basically it involves the creation of a couple of new ASG spots. It says that it will be, all of this is for 6 months and to be reviewed, and has this organigram at the back. What I'm wondering is is it accurate to assess that this involves new ASG posts, i.e. more spending? How does it relate to the Fifth Committee? And it was said here last week that the way to keep track of when people's contracts runs out is to look at vacancy announcements. So I wanted to ask you, will, for example, the Undersecretary General positions in DPA and DPKO, will there be a vacancy announcement, or is this something that will be done without any kind of public notice?
Well, I don't have anything to add to what Stefan said about that, which is exactly to look at the vacancy announcements. As you monitor those, that will become clear. Regarding any additional expenses, if there are additional expenses that need to be made, we would inform the member states, and particularly the Fifth Committee, about that. At this stage, we're in the early days of this process, and there's no concrete requests to make for additional spots.
But like Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Coordination and Senior Advisor on Policy, these are spots that are already in the budget?
There are some that will be in the budget. There are some that will be part of extra budgetary processes. If there is a need for further budgetary allocations, we'll inform the member states accordingly.
And then finally, there were some members of the transition team that I've never seen it announced that they've become UN officials, but in going to 38 for photo ops and other, they're there. So I'm just wondering, is there some way we can get a chart of, like, who's actually working up there, particularly the people that were on the transition but haven't been subject to any kind of press release since then in terms of what their position is?
Well, until the end of January, they're formally regarded as part of the transition team. Once January has ended, the transition period is over, and they will either have new positions or will go back to other jobs. But right now, their formal titles really has to do with their status as part of the transition team. That process is ongoing through this month.
Okay.
Have a good afternoon, everyone.
This week is the last week of the Obama administration, and that fact hasn't been missed by BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford.
Barack Obama has spoken to the nation as president for the last time. Hallelujah. The man I dub the more effective evil now gets a chance to make millions for himself after spending 8 years defending the wealth of the bankers and the rest of the 1%. Obama is going out like he came in, telling lies with great style and skill. So many lies. He said he favored giving unions the power to organize for better wages. He said the same thing when he was campaigning for his first term, promising to support the card check bill that would have allowed workers to rebuild their union membership. But he betrayed organized labor and did nothing to push the bill in Congress. The outgoing president pointed out that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't just vanish in the 60s, that these effects continue to plague black people. But 100 days after first taking the oath of office, Obama told reporters that he would not consider programs targeted at black communities, that blacks would have to depend on a rising tide to lift all boats, even though no such tide has ever risen for black people in America. Obama said the U.S. has led the world on the promise to save the planet. That's an outrageous lie. The U.S., China, and a few other powerful countries have been the problem, not the solution, to climate change. Obama spent his first term sabotaging every effort to create mandatory limits on emissions. The first black president acknowledged that many Americans are convinced that their government only serves the interests of the powerful. But he didn't take any of the blame, even though it was under his administration that Wall Street bankers were deemed too big to jail or even to indict. In the same dishonest fashion, Obama declared on Tuesday that we need to uphold laws against discrimination and in our criminal justice system, when, on his watch, no federal charges were brought against any killer cops, except one who'd already been indicted by local authorities. Obama got downright cocky in defense of Obamacare, the right-wing Republican health program that Obama adopted as his own. The president said, "If anybody can put together a plan that is demonstrably better, I will support it. But don't bet any money on the letter and spirit of Obama's promises on health care." Back in 2003, when Bruce Dixon and I asked him if he favored a single-payer health care system, Obama answered that he favored universal health care for all Americans and intended to introduce or sponsor legislation to that end. He kept saying that for the next 5 years until he was elected president, and then proceeded to isolate and crush supporters of single-payer, to the delight of the insurance and drug industries, which no longer had to fear single-payer. Obama is sneaky that way. Finally, Obama bragged that the U.S. has taken out thousands of terrorists, including bin Laden. What he didn't say was that his administration presided over the jihadist takeovers of Libya and much of Syria and Iraq. The truth is that tens of thousands of jihadists have been trained, armed, financed, and protected by the United States and its allies, not under Bush, but under Obama, making him fully responsible for the deaths of 500,000 people in those three countries alone. Not to mention Obama's other wars. But I've run out of time. The good thing is, so has Obama. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.